From the City of Angels near the Pacific Ocean, good morning, good evening, wherever you may be across the nation, around the world. I'm George Norrie. Welcome to Coast AM. Next hour, Thunderbolt of the Gods. And before we begin the program, our condolences to Coast guest Dr. Sherry Tenpenny. She, of course, is our expert on vaccines. Her husband, Kevin, has passed away unexpectedly, very sudden. Sherry, you have our deepest prayers, condolences, anything you need. We'll be in touch with you. Well, a story in the news at coasttocoastam.com. You've got to take a look at this. Is it part of an alien spaceship nestled under the dust of the moon, or is it a secret moon base occupied by humans? Speculation has exploded over these controversial images, which appear to show something unexplained on the surface of the moon. The triangular anomaly spotted on Google's map of the moon has rows of seven light-like dots at its edge. They've been likened to an alien base or a spaceship. You've got to take a look at it, and they've got video there too. Richard C. Hoagland thinks it could be photoshopped. He's still trying to find some of the original photographs, but it sure is strange. Bitter cold air is again settling southward from the Arctic into a large part of the eastern states. Unlike the outbreak from early January, this time the cold will have more staying power. The expert on the cold, author of Not by Fire But by Ice, about ice ages, Robert Felix, with us. Geez, what a winter this is, Robert.
Oh, George, I'm starting to get worried. You know, it does look like we're headed into a little ice age.
Well, you've been saying that for years, and here we are.
I have. You know, you're talking about this one is coming up. You know, there's a senior forecaster, Joe DeLeo, he's a meteorologist. He says this cold blast will last well past Super Bowl Sunday.
Wow.
And so I'm curious to see whether the Super Bowl will even be held or not. And more than that, you know, there's another senior meteorologist, Joe Bastardi. But he's talking about this thing is going to last probably for 10 to 15 days. Now, he said that last Arctic outbreak that we had, that was only, but that was 3 to 4 days. And that led to blackouts. Well, this time we've got 10 to 15 days coming with one shot after another. And he's just worried that this is the beginning of a siege that could have an immense impact on the country economically.
Well, there's a shortage of propane fuel and God knows what else, Robert. This is going to be a rough one this year.
It really is. You know, I've been telling people for years to have some food on hand, and I'm still saying it.
What?
I'm not selling food, but I'm sure saying you want to have some and then be prepared for it.
You're right about that. Robert, thanks so much. Robert's website, by the way, Ice Age Now. Info. There's no question that infant and child safety seats have helped slash highway death tolls in recent years. When installed and used properly, the National Highway Traffic Safety Administration says safety seats can reduce fatalities among infants by up to 71%, 54% for toddlers. Unfortunately, motor vehicle crashes still remain the number one cause of death among children. As part of its ongoing efforts to help reduce serious injuries among the nation's youngest motor vehicle passengers, the NHTSA recently announced it's looking to upgrade the federal standards for kid car seats sold in the U.S. by requiring them to pass a side impact crash test as well. We've got another story for you at coasttocoastam.com in the news. Take a look at the anorexic doll. It is provoking outrage. It's a new doll which turns its head away when offered food, and it has provoked outrage. Critics saying it could encourage young children to develop eating disorders. Mental health campaigners are calling for the doll to be banned on the basis it's unhealthy. They're concerned that the toy will encourage or normalize eating disorders in young children and say it is deeply worrying. China has the world's largest population, the second largest economy. In the past few years, it's seen an outstanding economic growth rate, but that's coming to an end. And does this mean a China bubble is about to burst? Let's check in with investment advisor Catherine Austin Fitz. Boy, if this bubble goes, look out, Catherine.
Well, it's true. You know, if you saw a real collapse in the Chinese economy, it would be pretty devastating for the global economy. But I think it's unlikely, George. There's no doubt that the growth in recent years has really been on sort of debt steroids at the local level in China, and they're struggling to reform some of the debt practices. But in one sense, it's no different from the rest of the world. We're all, you know, the U.S. has depended on unsustainable government debt to keep its growth going, ditto Europe, and you know, the whole planet is struggling with how are we going to get off the debt addiction and on to, you know, a more sound way of financing. I'm a big proponent of switching to a more of an equity-based model, and the question is, how's that going to happen? But I still think, you know, in any kind of growth like China's had, you need to pause, you need a consolidation that's healthy. So I think we're in for a healthy consolidation, and they've got a lot of debt problems they need to reform. But to me, the growth in China is going to continue so long as the global trade continues. You know, war can always stop this, but we've got to change the model from a debt model. It's too much debt in China, too much debt here. We've all got this problem.
One concern, what if China says we need some cash, so they need to cash in all these bonds and the debt they're holding, our debt?
Well, they've been converting a lot of the debt to, you know, buying assets around the world, buying hard assets. So, but there's no doubt that they've had, you know, in the short-term market, liquidity problems, and they're gonna need to take care of them. But they certainly have the financial resources, both in the sovereign wealth fund and in the banking system, to do it. So, and they have the international credit, so they have ways of handling liquidity. The problem they have is every time the central authorities intervene, they and you put more money in, then you stop the kind of, you know, adjustment. Sometimes people need to fail. Do you know what I mean?
Yeah, absolutely.
So the more we don't let, the more we have too big to fail, whether in China or here, the worse it gets.
Catherine's website, though, part of our Solari.com website, you can see all the things that she does and cover. Older women with higher levels of omega-3 fatty acids in their blood had slightly less brain shrinkage than women with low fatty acid levels in a new study. The results may suggest that omega-3s protect the brain from the loss of volume that happens with normal aging and is seen more severely in people with dementia. So there you go. Remember that. So do you say a little prayer during a pivotal play or wear lucky socks during a big game? Well, you're not alone. Just ahead of the 2014 Super Bowl, 50% of the sports fans see some aspect of the supernatural at play in sports, meaning that they either pray to God to help their team, they have thought that their team was cursed at some point in time, or they believe that God plays a role in determining the outcome of sporting events. These are reported in a new survey conducted by the Public Religion Research Institute. Well, it's unclear if they'll be arriving aboard the Millennium Falcon, but Carrie Fisher, Harrison Ford, and Mark Hamill will be hitting the set of Star Wars Episode 7 this spring. According to TV Guide, Fisher said that she, along with Ford and Hamill, will be arriving on set to reprise their roles as Princess Leia, Han Solo, and Luke Skywalker in March or April. The episode expected to open in December of 2015. Up next, Paul Smith joins us, author of Reading the Enemy's Mind. An hour, we're talking about remote viewing next on Coast to Coast AM. And welcome back to Coast to Coast. I've got to tell you, I love talking about remote viewing. It is fascinating. And of course, one of the best, Paul Smith, author of Reading the Enemy's Mind. Paul was an Army intelligence officer. He spent 7 of his 20 years serving as a remote viewer for the military Stargate remote viewing program. It existed. It happened. Paul was personally trained in controlled remote viewing by the creators of remote viewing, the late Ingo Swann and Hal Puthoff. And here he is on Coast to Coast. Always a pleasure, Paul. How are you?
I am great. And I miss you when I'm not talking to you, George.
Well, you know, every time I miss you, I pick out your book, Reading the Enemy's Mind, which is on my bookcase here in L.A., and there you are. So you don't go away. Plus, you know where I am all the time. You probably remote me.
Well, I try not to hover too much. You know, I don't want you to feel you know, like maybe you're being watched all the time.
Yeah, no, we don't want
except
that.
Except by NSA.
Hey, now, you just brought up something pretty darn fascinating. If somebody is tuned in, not the remote viewer, but they're the target, let's say, can they feel or perceive the remote viewing?
You know, it's hard to know that. I suspect it's possible, but how do you test that in a laboratory? I guess it could be done. That might be fun. We should try that experiment sometime.
Yeah, we really should. Just to say, you know what? I think, Paul, you were trying to remote view me at about 8 o'clock at night or whatever, mm-hmm. but that would be interesting. What's new with you, Paul? What's going on?
Well, I have to say 2013 was a pretty rough year for me.
What happened? Anything you can talk about?
Oh, yeah. In June, I had a massive mountain bike accident.
Oh, my God.
Put myself in an arm and a leg cast for 3 months. And then when I was on a business trip out to Vegas and to Utah and out to San Francisco for a very interesting workshop in remote viewing, my wife came down with appendicitis while we were on the road.
It's the worst.
And then there was a sad point. As soon as I got back from that trip, found out my dad had a terminal illness, and he passed away about a month later.
It wasn't a good year for you.
No, it wasn't. And shortly after that, I had a hip replacement, and I just recovered from that.
What did that be? Is that titanium?
Yes. At least they say it is. Of course, I haven't seen it.
Well, when they talk about replacing the hip, is it the entire hip or is it just a little portion?
They replace the ball part and they reline the socket and put in a polymer kind of a fitting.
Isn't that amazing what they can do?
Completely replace the joint, essentially.
And how long does it take to heal with an operation like that?
I was finally walking unaided and driving in about 6 weeks.
That's not bad, Paul.
It's not too bad. I mean, it still has some muscle soreness and stuff from all the damage they did, but I'll tell you, it feels way better than it did. It's amazing.
When all these events happen, all these unpleasant events happen, do you ever get to a point and you're simply saying, now, wait a minute, why me? My karma's good. I've been a good guy. Why me? Do you ever think about that?
You know, I know people who do, but I don't. I just kind of see it as life, you know, life happening.
It's part of living.
My dad was 87, you know, and I know exactly why I had the bike wreck. It was stupidity on my part. And the hip had been bothering me for a long time, you know, so the only surprise really, in a way, the only surprise was my wife's appendicitis. But, you know, modern medicine does some pretty miraculous things, and she was up and around within a day or so.
Yeah, they do. And I guess the appendicitis was the only thing you really couldn't predict, you know, other than the bike mishap. What'd you do? Go down a hill or what happened?
Yeah, I was headed down a hill, and I went too fast, and I tried to dodge an overhanging branch.
Ouch.
Yeah, and I came off. I fell through about 8 feet of clear air before I landed on the cement, so...
Were you wearing a helmet?
Oh, yes. I learned the hard way a while back that helmets are good. So
we lost Ingo Swann.
Yes. Yep.
And
yep, we did. And, of course, you know, his legacy lives on.
Sure does.
But it's so strange. I mean, I had a question. I'd call him up and I'd say, Ingo, what about this? And, of course, he'd give me a hard time most of the time. And we'd have a conversation. And, you know, I enjoyed being able to get those questions answered. And now, you know... he's not at the end of the telephone these days. So.
That's right. You can remote view him wherever he is. What's new in remote viewing these days, Paul? Anything?
Well, let's see. This latest challenge from Warren Buffett is not directly remote viewing, but there's a bunch of folks who want to try and remote view it.
Lot of money if you can pull that off.
That's right. $1 billion. It's a pretty challenging problem, though, because...
For people who don't know, Warren Buffett, the billionaire, wants people to predict the brackets for the NCAA basketball team. And I guess, and I haven't looked into it too much, does he want you to get the entire brackets accurately picked?
You have to get all of them.
All of them.
Exactly right. 100% right. And the odds are some orders of magnitude huge. I mean, it's in the quintillions, 18 zeros after whatever the number is. I don't remember now. I mean, that's massive.
A computer couldn't even pull it off.
Well, no, and it certainly couldn't anyway, because there's some unpredictable predictions you'd have to make. Now, it is theoretically possible for remote viewing to do it. There's this process called associative remote viewing, which I think we've discussed before, that allows you to predict the outcome of a future two-way choice, a binary outcome. And you could, and of course, each of the contests in the bracket is a binary choice. You know, it's a contest between two teams. There's going to be an either-or outcome. So you could use associative remote viewing to do it, but it would take, you'd have to make 63 predictions, and they'd have to be 100% accurate. And each tier of predictions that you did depend on you getting the previous tier absolutely correct. And in the end, you'd need probably about 100 to 150 people to do it with ARV. And you would increase your chances of winning. And this is just a ballpark kind of figure, but you go from five quintillion down to maybe one in a million or one in 500,000 or one in 100,000, something like that, which that's a dramatic decrease in the odds or improvement in the odds. But it's still not good enough odds to make anybody want to have to spend the next two months or whatever it is full time trying to predict it using remote viewing. So I don't anticipate anybody actually making a serious effort at it.
I'm going to cut a deal with a time traveler who will come back and give me the list, and then we'll divvy it up. I'll pull you in on it too, Paul.
Hey, listen, I'll be happy to be a go-between here.
Now, wouldn't that be interesting if time travel did exist and that they did have the ability to come back? If one of them picked up on this, heard about it, it would be very easy for them to go get the bracket for March of 2014 and fill it all out and win that $1 billion.
Yeah, one of the Back to the Future movies is kind of based on that premise. Somebody had a sports gazette or something, from the future in the past, and they were making all the sports bets and winning them all, right? That would be awesome.
Is remote viewing more accurate looking at current events as they occur or into the future?
It's more accurate on current and past than it is into the future. The one exception being associative remote viewing, which is about equal in accuracy to present and past. But the future, as they say, doesn't exist yet, right? And so when you try and remote view the future, the best you're going to get is one or another of the possible futures that are directions the future might go.
Might go, and that's changeable.
That is changeable. Thank goodness.
Right, but current events, things that are going right now, for example,
those are fairly reliably remote viewable. Yes.
If you want to see if Iran is still working on its nuclear enrichment program, you would do something like that, or whatever it might be.
Mm-hmm.
Give us some techniques. In terms of, for people who want to get going into remote viewing, how do they start?
Well, the first thing is to understand the rules, okay? And there's Joe McMonigle calls protocols, right, is the conditions under which you remote view. And the first one is you can't know what the target is that you remote view. Now, people say, what?
Yeah.
How am I going to remote view something? I don't know what it is.
I don't know what I'm looking for.
And there's a reason why you can't know it. But first, how we did it in the military and how we still do it when we do is somebody else has to assign you the target so that you don't know what the target is you're being given. And the reason is because if you know what the target is, then everything you already know about that target or everything you can imagine or guess or speculate about it is all going to be there in your head confusing the issue. When what you want is a clean signal that brings you the real data about it, not what you're guessing about it.
So there is a bias that comes in if you're familiar with what you're going to be doing.
Absolutely. And has been shown time and time again when people know what the target is they're remote viewing up front. And when I say no, I'm talking consciously aware of it. Your subconscious knows. But it isn't going to confuse the issue. It's your conscious awareness that confuses the issue. If you are consciously aware of the target, time and time again, people who remote view, what we call front-loaded, mess things up.
Hold on, Paul. We're going to come back, talk more with you about remote viewing right here on Coast to Coast AM. Welcome back. Paul Smith with us as we talk about remote viewing this hour. We'll take your calls as well. Paul, when you were remote viewing, and of course you still do it, but when you were doing it with the Army, with the military, how would you categorize your accuracy? Was it pretty good, average? What was it?
Well, it's a hard thing to measure, but and the remote viewer, him or herself, has probably the toughest time gauging that. But the folks who are managing programs, Skip Atwater, Gene Lesman, some of the other folks, basically said that they felt like I was one of the best ones they had. So
good for you.
That's, you know, I don't want to sound like I'm bragging, but
Brad.
I guess I did what I was supposed to. Well, I've had some amazing successes, and we've talked about those over the years on the show.
Yeah, we have.
And when you have those kind of successes, you have to say you must be doing something right.
How was our friend Major Ed Dames? Was he pretty accurate?
Well, he actually wasn't really a remote viewer at the unit. He wasn't hired to be a remote viewer. He did do some operational viewings there, but he worked more as a trainer and as a project manager, and he worked as the operations officer for a while. And he had a lot of different roles, different hats while he was there. When he did the remote viewing, I actually don't know how well he did because they didn't allow us to see other people's work.
Uh-huh.
And that makes sense. You don't want to see what other viewers are doing because it might mess up, you know, add extra noise to what you're doing, you know.
Well, why did they disband the project?
Well, it was a mixture of, well, it was a mixture. It was because the supporters of it retired or died. And it left the ones who are skeptical of it still running the show. So at the time the program was canceled at the CIA, the director of the CIA, the guy in charge, was a remote viewing skeptic. He was known for having thrown people out of his office if he even tried to brief him on remote viewing. So that's kind of the mentality of the people who are making the decisions as to whether the program existed or not.
Were the Soviets at the time continuing to do their remote viewing, or did they disband too?
Well, of course, by then the Soviet Union was gone.
Was it gone by then? Okay.
Yeah.
So how about just Russia? Did they do it?
Well, I mean, the Soviets were doing it up towards, when did it dissolve? 89, 90?
In the 80s.
Somewhere right around 89, 90. And as far as we know, up until then, they were doing it. Whether or not the Russians continued to do it, I suspect they did not continue to do it, at least for the first while, because Russia was somewhat in a state of chaos, and they didn't have, you know, their cash flow was really bad, and they were having a hard time making ends meet anyway. And so they probably cut back to the absolute bare essentials, and remote viewing would not be one of those things. But these days, whether they're doing it, continue to do it or not, I don't know. But I think you probably know of Ed May.
Yeah,
he took over the program from Hal Puthoff at SRI. I'm throwing out all kinds of names that a lot of you folks probably don't know who these are.
Well,
but
some of them.
But at any rate, he has actually gotten to know quite a bit about the Russian/Soviet program, and he has some books in the works that is going to lay all of that out. So I'm looking forward to seeing what comes, because that's a big black hole in our knowledge base, is exactly what the Russians did and how well they did it. I mean, there's things we know, but it's kind of, you know, there's a lot of holes in our knowledge.
Soviet Union disbanded 1991, by the way.
Okay, good. Thank you.
Did anybody see that? Did anybody see that happening?
I don't know. I was in the middle of Desert Storm at the time. So I was,
yeah,
I was out of the program and you know, worrying much more about Saddam Hussein and so on. So I don't know if any remote viewers actually predicted that.
Are you still remote viewing?
I do, yeah. I do practice. I do operational when we have a program, you know, a project going on. And, you know, occasionally I'll do an ARV, you know, if we got a worthwhile project. So
is it like the old adage, the more you do, the better you get?
Yes, that's true. Which means I should be doing more or I'm going to lose my edge, right?
That's right.
but of course, when you have bicycle Stay accidents tuned. And hip replacements, it makes it a little challenging, of course. But we did do an interesting thing for Japanese TV. Lynn Buchanan and I were asked by they have like their BBC, I think, came over and did a documentary on remote viewing, and Lynn and I took turns remote viewing several times. Now, we got the feedback, but I can't tell you about it because I don't think the program is aired yet. But we got some things wrong, some things right. It was quite fun, actually. But
all right, let's take some calls for you. Let's go to Rusty in Houston, Texas, east of the Rockies. Hey, Rusty, go ahead.
Hi, George. I'd first like to say I'm a truck driver out of Texas, and I want to thank you for making my evenings incredibly entertaining.
Thank you, Rusty. I appreciate what you
do.
Hey,
Rusty, I'm here in Austin. Are you on the road right now?
I am. I just left Houston. I'm headed into Louisiana.
Oh, you're going the wrong way. You're leaving Texas.
Yeah, I'll be turning around and coming right back tomorrow, though. You can't stay away from Texas too long, you know. I'd like to ask you, have you ever remote viewed the triangle on the moon, or is it possible? And if so, what can you tell us about it?
I haven't remote viewed that. But that's fairly new anyway, as far as I know. I think I heard George talking about it. I don't know about that. But I did do some remote viewing of the moon for Ingo Swann back in the mid to late 90s. He called me up and said, hey, I've got some stuff I want you to do. Some sessions, and I'm not telling you what they are, obviously, because you remote view blind, right? And they were turned out to be moon targets, which I had no idea there were any issues with the moon, and it turns out there are. And I got some interesting things about it, and at this point, I'm debating about how much I can talk about. I've said that before on the show when Ingo was alive. Now that he's passed away, I'm thinking that I might be able to talk more about it, but I have to figure out how to present it and that kind of thing.
Oh, really?
Yeah, I did find some interesting stuff.
You've got a major conference coming up the end of June, of course, the International.
Yes, and I have a surprising, exciting announcement about that, too.
Oh, really? When is the announcement? You're going to tell us now or later?
We have picked your show to make it on.
What do you mean? Oh, the announcement?
The announcement,
And yeah. When are you going to make it? Now?
I could make it now, or we could wait a little bit longer and tease people. What do you want? How do you want to handle it?
Well, that's go for it now.
All right. So, you know, every year we have, almost every year, we sponsor there's a nonprofit organization called the International Remote Viewing Association. We sponsor an annual remote viewing conference, and we have leading lights from all over the remote viewing community come and give talks. We've had Russell Targ and Hal Putoff and Ingo Swann and all of the big names.
The giants.
And this year we have a keynote speaker who isn't directly remote viewing related, but he's really a big draw. And he's talking about something that I think is closely related to remote viewing. And you've had him on your show.
Who is it?
His name is Evan Alexander.
Oh, he is the doctor who talked about the life after death.
That's right. He had a massive near-death experience.
He sure did.
And we're not talking about just anybody having a near-death experience. We're talking about a leading neuroscientist and neurosurgeon who, by all rights, should be believing that the mind and consciousness just is a function of the brain. And apparently he did believe that until he had this experience.
He wrote a book, Proof of Heaven, I think.
Absolutely. I have it sitting right here on my desk. It was an awesome book. He is going to be our keynote speaker.
All right, super. He's a good guy.
Yeah, he is. It's going to be fascinating, I'm sure. And it isn't directly remote viewing related, but they both have to do with non-local consciousness. And when I was involved in the remote viewing program, back in the early 80s, in fact, I became fascinated by the near-death literature because I could see echoes between what I was doing at Fort Meade and what these people were reporting. Now, not necessarily, you know, being visited by relatives and meeting some kind of divine figure or anything like that, but the kind of experience they were having, the way that they experienced it, reminded me very much of what what I was doing, what I was learning. And I think it's going to be very exciting to have Dr. Alexander there telling us about his experiences and then being able to interact with him and discuss the tool known as remote viewing, which is a non-local consciousness ability.
Cool.
And then
that's
this
different.
Non-local experience with near-death experience. I think it'd be wonderful.
Well, let's go to Jan now, Sacramento, California. Hey, Jan, go ahead.
Hello, how are you today?
Good, Jan.
Thank you for taking my call. Years ago on Coast to Coast, there was a thing on remote viewing, and they gave instruction on how to do so, so the listeners could practice the basic principles and learn a lower echelon version of the remote viewing.
Mm-hmm.
Are you going to be giving us, imparting this information to us tonight?
Well, I don't know how much time we have. I'll tell you where you can find it, okay? That could have been a show I was on. I don't recall
it. It might have been.
Yeah,
because I do know with Ed, and he's been on with me a lot, we really didn't go into techniques.
Yeah.
We
I'll
did
tell you
with
where you can go for just a very basic experience. If you go to the website for the International Remote Viewing Association, which is IRVA, IRVA.org, and you go there, and as I recall, on the right side, there is a link to how to do a simple remote viewing session. And that'll give you a good basic understanding of a very fundamental kind of approach to it.
Paul, how powerful do you think your dream state is?
How powerful is my dream state?
Yeah, to accomplish things, to also do remote viewing, let's say in your dreams.
You know, that's interesting. I don't know the answer to that. I don't usually have any kind of ESP sorts of experiences in my dreams. I think part of the reason of that is because I do it so much in my waking state, right? I think a lot of people who don't do remote viewing tend to experience ESP in their dreams more because they don't have an outlet otherwise, right? One of the more prominent leaders in the original government program was a guy named Dale Graff. And Dale, his main focus is ESP and dreams. And he's got some remarkable experiences to tell. And I suspect many of your listeners do as well.
So I tried to do a quick remote viewing of you right now.
Uh-huh.
Are you kind of like lying down on your side?
I'm sort of slouched back in my chair. It could look that way, yes.
It's because you're not propped up fully.
Right. I'm kind of reclining back, leaning towards my left, because that's the side that didn't get the hip replaced.
Interesting. Okay. First time caller, do I get an A on that one?
Sure, why not?
All right. Let's go to Bluff City, Tennessee. First time caller. Hello, Stephen.
Hello. Oh, it's just excellent. Thank you for taking my call.
My pleasure.
This remote viewing has been a part of my life since before 95. And I'm just a huge fan of the show, and thank you. I got a few things I'd like to ask first. I have read David Morehouse's books, The Psychic Warrior, and then I went ahead and picked up, he has another book called The Remote Viewing, The Complete User's Manual for Coordinate Remote Viewing with the CD and everything.
Mm-hmm.
Are you familiar, have you worked at the Monroe Institute at all, Paul? Because I was under the impression that when SRI was still not out in public eyes yet, that everybody, the Institute was working, the Stargate program and whatnot, was working with Robert Monroe.
Well we did have a connection. I've been to the Monroe Institute for a program they had
good people.
That we remote viewers went through. Right.
Right. And then that kind of then was that the lead in then to what you guys were doing in trying to pull everything together and make this more scientific so that it could be a repeated process.
Well, yeah, although that was more SRI doing that. The Monroe Institute is more experiential. I'd like to point you to my book on that because I talked.
I'm definitely going to read your book.
It's a great book. It's
read. Yeah, Reading the Enemy's Mind. It's you probably have to pick it up off the used book market because right now it's only in print and Kindle. But But it's definitely give you a background on the SRI part of it and on the Monroe Institute, how the Monroe Institute was involved and all of that.
Are you familiar with Lynn McTaggart?
Yes. In fact, I did a workshop for her over in England. Did a three-day remote viewing workshop that she sponsored, and I was the main figure there. So
well, she wrote a book called The Field. He was at the University of Michigan in Ann Arbor. There was the quest for the secret force of the universe, and apparently Lynn decided that he wanted to take a three-prong approach. Using remote viewing, transcendental meditation, the city version, and then went to the Monroe Institute as well to learn how to do out-of-body.
I don't know if she did transcendental meditation. She certainly was involved in meditation itself,
Her theory about the field is fascinating, Paul, how things are all out there and interconnected. You know, I've always believed that, too.
Mm-hmm. Yep. And she's of course, had a further publication, I think it was called The Intentionality Experiment, which talked about the power of human intention.
That's right. And she wanted to lessen crime in Washington, D.C. And apparently it works. You know, when the masses get together for the common good and that mindset works, you know, whether it's a universal prayer or whatever, it seems to work. That's an amazing thing. So give me your overall view on, and we know you and I do it, that remote viewing works, but how does it work? What is it tapping into? How does this all-knowing seeing eye that's not connected to us physically, how does it work?
Well, I could give you the answer that my old friend Bill Ray says. He says it's just magic, but obviously that's not a sufficient answer for most of us. And there's a couple of different views on it. One speculation is it has something to do with quantum non-locality. We've talked about that on your show before, too, and unfortunately we probably don't have time right now to go through that because that's a little bit complicated. But there are possible scientific answers for it. My own belief is that it has to do with something is outside of physicality, is non-physical, in the sense that consciousness and human intention exist, I suspect, independent of physical existence. In other words, the mind is not the brain. The mind is you know, it needs the brain to some degree, but there's more to our consciousness and our minds than are dependent on the physical apparatus. And so I think that ultimately we're going to find out that it is a non-physical attribute of the universe that allows us to do it. So
and it's, you know, very accessible and probably is very natural.
Yeah, you know, there's probably a lot of folks who don't know a lot about remote viewing. One of the things I did while I was laid up is I created an introductory video that people can get an overview of remote viewing. Maybe I ought to suggest that.
Where do we go? To your website?
Yeah, you could go to my website, and right under the picture there's a link. Or you can just go to YouTube and type in remote viewing martial arts.
Okay, there you are. Paul, thanks again. I appreciate it. Good luck at your conference coming up in June, which may seem like it's many months away, but it's right around the corner. This is going to be a fast year, too. Up next, we're going into space. Come along with me on Coast to Coast AM.